Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And you can contact us with questions or comments or what have you at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week's episode features a segment run by the Prison Radio Show on CKUT in Montreal, Quebec. In it, episode host Noah interviews Tori Pegram, a longtime supporter of the Angola 3, about the case of Albert Woodfox, otherwise known as Shaka Sinkay, who's the last remaining incarcerated member of the Angola 3. Before that interview, however, Noah features dramatically audioscaped narrative by Robert King, who was one of the Angola 3 and was released in 2001. For more on this radio project, check out ckut.ca and search their great archive or great schedule for Off the Hour Thursday edition. An update for the case of Albert Woodfox. There's a call out to have people come out to the Baton Rouge courthouse, where on Monday he'll be having a federal bail hearing. Here's the text from the call out. We just received word that Albert's bail hearing will proceed on Monday, March 2nd at 9:30 a.m. in courtroom 6 of the U.S. Middle District Court of Baton Rouge, 777 Florida Street. Albert will be present, and though we know it is short notice, local supporters are urged to attend if possible. If you have not done so, please sign the Amnesty International petition calling on Governor Jindal to not oppose bail for Albert. And another update. Albert release arguments heat up as Monday's bail hearing approaches. 48 hours ago, the state of Louisiana submitted a written request for the federal district court judge James A. Brady to cancel Albert's Monday, March 2nd bail hearing on the grounds that his re-indictment by the state moves the question of release from federal to state jurisdiction. Though Albert has retained his right to petition for bail in the state system if needed, Albert's legal team maintains the jurisdiction over custody and release properly remains with the federal courts until the habeas appeal process is complete, regardless of whether he has been reindicted or not. Whether or not Judge Brady agrees that it is within his jurisdiction to grant release to Albert on bail, he still indisputably retains a sweeping power to define the conditions of release however he sees fit as part of his final mandate granting habeas corpus relief. As the petition, or as the call-out says, please join Albert in court on Monday to support his strong and just petition for release. His freedom is long overdue. Another note. Here's a video that's... I'm reading from angola3news.blogspot.com and with recent updates from late February. New video citing 43 years of injustice. Amnesty International interviews UN Special Rapporteur Juan Mendez about Albert Woodfox. Amnesty International just released a new video entitled Free Albert Woodfox, 43 Years of Injustice. It's on YouTube and Facebook. Featuring an interview with Juan Mendez, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment. The video was made in support of Amnesty's new petition campaign focusing on Albert's pending application for release on bail. In 2013, declaring that, quote, 4 decades in solitary confinement can only be described as torture, unquote, Mendez called for Albert's immediate release from solitary confinement. Speaking about Albert in this new video, Juan Mendez says, quote, Mr. Woodfox is spending his days in solitary confinement. His convictions have been reversed, and the state is appealing them. So in fact, he should be considered an innocent man until his guilt or innocence is resolved. There's no question that his conditions inflict on him the kind of pain and suffering of a mental nature that is associated with torture, and I think that it should stop, unquote. Yeah. So you can write to Albert Woodfox, otherwise known as Shaka Sinkay, at Albert Woodfox, number 72148, West Feliciana Parish Detention Center, and that's F-E-L-I-C-I-A-N-A, P.O. Box 2727, St. Francisville, Louisiana, 70775. Also, I'd like to share an update to an episode from a few weeks back in which The Final Straw spoke with members of the Free Alabama and Mississippi movements. Today, March 1st, 2015, at 1 p.m. Central Time, there was a call for a prayer meeting out back of the main yard at St. Clair Correctional Facility in Springville, Alabama. It was announced days ago that workers at St. Clair would refuse their work details in a nonviolent act of civil disobedience. In response to the call-out, Warden Davenport called in a riot squad to the facility, but they were called back within a day or so due to pressure from the outside for the warden to recognize that the prisoners were calling for a work stoppage and not a riot. This is not to say that there have not been retaliations from the guards at St. Clair. Word has it that from a support page that prisoners have been receiving decreased portions of food for announcing their refusal to give up their labor to profit the prison owners and state administrators in light of such horrendous circumstances. More info on St. Clair strike and the Free Alabama and Mississippi movements can be found at freealabamamovement.com and alabamaprisonwatch.org. And finally, an update on Sean Swain's situation since he was transferred to SOCF, the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility, in Lucasville. So here's from his website, and I'll be editing some of the audio as we go. We've got news about Sean's property and transfer to Lucasville, as well as the ongoing legal battle. Call-in success, number one. Last week, we called the regional director, Rob Jeffries. In response, they held a meeting that very afternoon, and 4A transfer prisoners, including Sean, got most of their property back the following day. Thank you to everyone who called in and who mailed Sean letters. The bleep weasels brought him a stack of 27 letters that they had to spend the morning opening and reading through. Property destruction, number two. Sean had 37 books when he left OSP. SOCF only allows people to have 10 books, so they arbitrarily threw away 27 of Sean's books, which they're allowed to do according to ODRC policy, because ODRC are fascists, and like all fascists, they like to burn books. So it won't do any good to complain about that. But among the books they threw away were Sean's Quran and Taurat. These they are not allowed to trash because the Supreme Court has decided that when the Constitution says freedom of religion, that means fascists can't throw the Quran in the garbage. SOCF staff said that it was a mistake and even apologized. It was unclear whether the accidental destruction of these holy books resulted from staff being ignorant to the policy of not destroying the Qurans, or whether in their fascistic book-destroying glee, they failed to pay attention to what they were tossing into the trash. Of course, they could also just be lying. It could be they intentionally trashed Sean's Quran to prove that they could get away with it. Are they book-burning lunatics or just really bad at the job? We're not sure, but either way, they suck. Number three, delays. On Tuesday, the 4A transfers got their basic property, socks, underwear, and stuff. High-value items like electronics are titled, which means that they're engraved with each person's name and inmate number, and keep a record of, and a record is kept of it. Since all these guys are coming from OSP, the property is already engraved, and the records just need to be updated to reflect the transfer. Sean's been transferred around the state of Ohio many times. This record updating process should take a few minutes for each prisoner. Sean figures it should take about 3 hours to update the records for the transferred titled property for all 37 transferred 4A prisoners. SOCF staff is saying it'll take them 10 days to do that 3 hours worth of work. Among the property is Sean's JP4 device. This is a sort of like a tablet computer with lots of constraints on it. This device allows Sean to write longer emails while in his cell and upload them to the kiosk. Sean believes the delay in titling the property is to prevent him from getting this device so he can send information to update this site, that being seanswain.org. If you want to call and complain about the destruction of Sean's property or the unreasonable delay in getting the titled property to the 4A transfers, please contact Rob Jeffries, the SE Southeast Regional Director at the ODRC at, and get your pencils ready, kiddies, 614-752 1104. That's 614-752-1104. Or you could email Rob at rob.jeffreys, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y-S, at odrc.state.oh.us. You could even send snail mail to Rob Jeffreys, title being SE Regional Director, 770 West Broad Street, Columbus, Ohio, 43222. Finally, number four, court update. 2 weeks ago, Rick Kerger filed a temporary restraining order to prevent the ODRC from blocking Sean's access to video visits and other forms of communication. The judge ordered a hearing that should have happened on February 27th, but the state requested the hearing to be pushed back to the following Friday. Date on that being... Ooh. Yeah. The 6th. Oh. The court is not available on the 6th, so the judges push it back to Friday the 13th of March. Someone is going to be unlucky that day. Let's hope it's the Bleep Weasels. The last portion of the show will feature newish tracks from various punk and post-punk projects such as Anasazi, Shadow House, and more. And now, here's Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Come like a bomb! The last couple of years, there's been a building concept that the NFL franchise in Washington, D.C. needs to change its name. Its current name is a slur against Native Americans, and the team logo is the profile of a tribal chief in full regalia. Team owner Dan Snyder has fought to keep the race a slur, claiming it's meant to honor First Nations people. Far less has been said about the Major League Baseball franchise in Cleveland, Ohio, the Cleveland Indians. Their logo is a red-faced Sambo caricature called Chief Wahoo with a feathered headband. Recently, Chief Wahoo was removed from Indian ball caps and replaced by a block C, but he remains prominently on their sleeves and on other team memorabilia. I think it's a hard argument to say that Chief Wahoo is meant to honor First Nations people. To put this in its proper context, imagine, for example, that the team was instead called the Cleveland Japs and featured a round-faced, squinty-eyed, buck-toothed caricature that they claimed honored Asians. Would that be tolerated in the 21st century? And yet the Cleveland Indians and Chief Wahoo are virtually unquestioned. There's a double standard when it comes to First Nations people and their dignity. I would also suggest that it's no coincidence this insult continues with an Ohio sports team. The Ohio River Valley was the first area beyond the 13 colony where settlers encroached, contrary to U.S. law. As more colonizers stole more tribal land, Native Americans defended their right to exist. The U.S. sent General Josiah Harmar not to defend native land rights, but to defend white colonizers who had violated U.S. law by trespassing into the Ohio River Valley in the first place. When Harmar's forces were decimated after attacking native tribes on their own land, the U.S. sent General Mad Anthony Wayne. Just an observation here, but if you're looking for a peaceful resolution, you don't typically send someone nicknamed Mad Anthony. General Wayne so thoroughly exterminated First Nations people, they named a town after him, Fort Wayne, Indiana. There's a long history of naming towns after genocidal murderers who obliterate Native American tribes. Columbus, for example. Columbus is Ohio's capital. Columbus and his men did such a thorough job destroying the Taino people, they went from an estimated 11 million in 1492 to zero just about 100 years later. Bartolome de las Casas describes how Columbus's men would yank Taino babies from their mother's arms and dash their heads on the rocks for sport, or chop them into pieces in front of their mothers to use them as dog food, or see who could slice through the most infants with one swing of a sword. Exterminate an entire tribe, and Ohio names its capital after you. Anyway, back to Ohio. The genocide in Ohio was historically remarkable because it marked the first recorded instance of biological warfare, as colonizers used smallpox-infected blankets to deliberately wipe out whole populations. Purposeful mass murder of human beings whose only crime was living peacefully in their own place. Even after the Treaty of Greenville in 1795 set aside the majority of Ohio as unceded Indian territory, the slaughter didn't stop. 8 years later, Ohio was a state, and the First Nations people were erased, though according to treaty they still own this area to this very day. This instance of genocide in Ohio opened the door for westward expansion, and the pattern repeated itself over and over. It's a process praised by Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf, who admitted that his ambitious expansion plans were inspired by the wholesale extermination process that began in the colonization of Ohio. So it's in this context of murder and theft and treachery that we have to consider the honor intended by the red-faced Sambo called Chief Wahoo, and the use of the term Indian by the colonizer sports team. When the field where they play, according to U.S. treaty, still belongs to the First Nations people, who are now ridiculed by the smiling, feather-banded face on the sleeve pageant. Maybe the Cleveland team could change their name to something more appropriate, the Cleveland Mad Anthonys, or the Cleveland Mass Murderers, or the Cleveland Treaty Breakers, perhaps. Something to reflect a centuries-long history of playing and fighting on Hitler's favorite team. And I'm not just talking about baseball. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're boycotting all Ohio tourism, including Cedar Point and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, until the Cleveland baseball team changes its name, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address at Sean Swain 243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route number 728, Lucasville, Ohio 45699. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. And now here's that promised segment from CKUT Radio, where the host of the prison radio show, Noah, interviews Tori Pegram on the case of the Angola 3. Following the segment of former Angola 3 prisoner Robert King describing his decades in solitary confinement and the case that put himself, Albert Woodfox, and Herman Wallace, comprising the Angola 3, in that deep and dark hole, King was released in 2001.
If this was a condition in which you were there for a few months, it might be okay. It's not, you know. But if you were in a condition like this, or in confinement with condition like this for up to 10, 15, 20, 30 years, well, it kind of catches up with you. When I was in prison, you asked me what kept me going. I would probably tell you the fact that I was innocent and I needed to get out of prison. And my main focus was to stay as sane as I could in order to accomplish this. Alvin and Herman are still in solitary-like conditions. And both were charged with allegedly participating in the death of a correction officer. But again, since that time, all evidence showed that they were targeted simply because they were members of the Black Panther Party, and that there's really no evidence, you know, no forensic or otherwise physical evidence linking them to the crime. Like I say, when I think about the 10 years in which, you know, I've had time to be out here, that is 10 more years that they are there. When they went to prison, the prison was considered the worst in the nation, and they got people together. They brought in ideology that despite the fact that you were a prisoner, you still had some rights. And because of this, the administration saw them as being threats. Fearful of crime, so whenever one is charged with a crime, a lot of time it doesn't make a difference whether or not this person is innocent or guilty. They feel, some people feel, and I've heard jurors say, well, this individual here, they must have done something. This is a type of mentality that is cultured. I mean, it is, you know, nurtured in American society. think while we focus on the condition of confinement, I think the bigger focus is on prison. I think we have to begin to see prison as being a tantamount or equal to slavery. I think people in the United States need to know that the 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery. Instead, the 13th Amendment, you know, if you read the wording, it says slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist on these shores except one who has been duly convicted of a crime. How many people who have been duly convicted of crime but who are actually innocent? Because as long as we have prison, slavery reigns.
That was Robert King speaking about his own case and the cases of Albert Wood Fox and Herman Wallace, who together make up the Angola Three. Sadly, Herman Wallace died in October of 2013, 3 days after being released from prison. Albert Wood Fox remains in solitary confinement, but has recently received good news. We'd like to welcome Tori Pegram back on Prison Radio Show. Welcome, Tori.
Hi, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. Can you share the good news Albert recently received?
Yes. Just about a week ago, Albert had been very patiently waiting since almost 2 years ago. In February of 2013, his conviction was overturned for a third time. This time, a finding of discrimination in the selection of the grand jury foreperson was made by a federal district court. And it has been 2 years since that he's been waiting for the state to exhaust all of their appeals within the appeals court. They were trying to, of course, reverse that decision. And he just found out that they have upheld the decision unanimously. The state then took the final step of asking the entire court to review it, although it was a unanimous decision in Albert's favor, and they declined to do that. So all the appeals are exhausted, and Albert's conviction stands overturned officially without recourse for the state. So that's great news for Albert.
Yeah, wow. So can you already did a bit, but can you maybe just elaborate a bit or sort of walk us through a bit more specifically the last few years of struggle that have led up to this point?
Sure. You know, Albert's struggle, gosh, I wish it had only been the last few years. As your listeners know, I've been on a few times, and I know you guys have been following the case over the decades of struggle. But, you know, Albert, this is now the third time that his conviction has been overturned. It was overturned once. He was retried and again found guilty. But that second conviction was also overturned now twice. The first time it was overturned, it was reinstated on the basis of a law, sort of a relatively little known law, but a really pernicious law that was passed during the Clinton administration, actually in the 90s, called the AEDPA. It sort of gutted a lot of the U.S.'s habeas protections, as your listeners may know, since they're pretty well versed in this stuff. Habeas laws are some of the oldest laws in terms of in the entire canon of law. They're hundreds of years old, and it more or less just allows those that are incarcerated to challenge their incarceration. So there was a revision to those laws in the U.S. in the 90s, which made it much harder for the federal government to step in and overturn state decisions. And so, although the federal government did acknowledge that there were serious constitutional problems in Albert's case, that perhaps they did not rise to the rather squishy standard of the new law that required them to be sort of intentionally injurious to the person. So, so his conviction was reinstated, but it was then again overturned based on this discrimination in the selection of the grand jury. So so it now stands overturned, and this time it will not be reinstated so because we've just completed that process. And we just found out about an hour ago, I think probably you don't know this yet because we haven't gotten press releases out, that the state has chosen to reindict and apparently will be trying to retry Albert for a third time for the crime. So pretty soon, he will not necessarily be freed yet. He may have to actually prove his innocence this time. But this time around, unlike previous times, he has amassed, legions of support, sort of from every corner of the advocacy world. I mean, that includes nonprofits, legislative support, sort of state and federal legislators that are in his corner, legal support in terms of a legal team that's been on the case now since about 2000, which seems like a really long time, but they were not there to defend him the last time he was retried and reconvicted. So although the state sort of stubbornly refuses to give up this fight, we are not worried about this newest development because we really think that this is going to be the main event. This is actually what Albert has been waiting for the whole time, an opportunity to prove to the world that he is innocent. And now that he is armed with a competent legal team and people in the world who are aware of his story and situation, he can quite passionately and quite, I think, definitively argue his case for innocence to a jury for the first time, as it were. I mean, although he's been in front of juries before, none of those opportunities were fair opportunities. They have now been judged and overturned for having numerous constitutional violations that made them not a fair shake at telling his side of the story. So we are, although we sort of wish the state would give up at any turn and stop wasting taxpayer money and on an innocent man who's now almost 70 years old and has spent nearly 43 years in solitary confinement, we're not afraid of this newest development because I think we're quite confident that he can demonstrate his innocence quite easily.
Okay. That's I guess as good news as that can be, considering that they are wanting to try him again, with a whole lot more support this time, which's so important, obviously. In terms of people coming out in support of Albert and his release, over the past 4 years, a lot of different groups have come out, including most recently the Association of Humanist Sociology. Can you talk a bit about the support that Albert and Herman have received in the last few years and whether or not that's had an impact on these different court decisions that you've been referencing?
Sure, yeah. I know for the listeners who haven't been following, and this is the first time you've heard, all of this is rather complicated, and it's, I'm trying to simplify as much as possible, but it is because these legal fights have spanned decades. And I mean, what's important to know and very special to know about Herman, Albert, and Robert in this context is that they are unlike most people who begin these fights. I mean, I think that most people who are wrongfully incarcerated try to get their story out, but it has taken them decades to do so. But bit by bit, they have managed to amass the support of, sort of innumerable individuals and organizations. Like I said, they have congresspeople both at the state and federal level spoken out on their behalf, who have censured the state for their behavior, who have promised to investigate some of the unconstitutional and inhumane practices and conditions of confinement that they've been held in. You have Amnesty International, who has strongly been an advocate in the case for over a decade now. They've done what they do best, sort of, international advocacy work, including petitioning and media advocacy. They have, quite importantly, a large team of pro bono and privately funded attorneys that are handling both their criminal cases and the civil suit that the three of them filed together back in 2000. The civil suit is separate from their bids for freedom from the murder conviction, wrongful murder conviction. The civil suit actually alleges that their conditions of confinement, AKA being held in solitary confinement for, over four decades, should constitute legally cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which up until this point, there is no legal precedent for in the U.S. I mean, you may think that that's somewhat of a no-brainer, that if someone is held in, a 6 by 9 foot cell the size of, half of some people's bathtubs, that, that that would just automatically qualify as cruel and unusual punishment, but it has not yet been established as such. So that is sort of a tangential part of their fight, but a sort of centrally important one. I will say that the support that they've garnered over the years is absolutely the reason why they are here now. I mean, it seems mind-boggling that they could have so much support for such a sustained period of time. I mean, most of the support has come since 2000, so we're talking about 15 years now, but 15 years with this many high-profile, high-powered people that are outraged and actively speaking out against the case has somehow not quite been enough to get them out of prison. And I think that what that shows is not that that advocacy has not been effective, but just sort of how high sort of the summit is for them to reach, you know, the obstacle in terms of getting someone who is wrongfully convicted out of prison in the U.S. is made nearly impossible for most people. Certainly that it's playing out here. However, I do think that especially in Albert's case, he now has amassed a critical mass of support. He has a very competent legal team on his side. He has people that are ready to really set the record straight when this does go to retrial. Again, we were kind of hoping perhaps they would not seek retrial, but we were aware that the state at every turn has wanted to defend their poor decision to try these guys in the first place, and so we are looking forward to the opportunity to sort of utilize all of the support that has been garnered up until this point to their benefit. And just to add very briefly, they gathered all of this support on their own. The very first legal writs that began their process towards freedom were filed actually by Herman, Albert, and Robert themselves. They all taught themselves the law from their cells, even though for almost a decade, books were not allowed to be in their cells. They had to smuggle in legal books. Eventually, it became legal for them to get them from a prison library. But these are young men, older men who went to prison at a very, very young age, managed to teach themselves the law, managed to write letters to organizations seeking help that eventually got their cases into court and got, other people to come in and help them mount this fight in a coordinated way. So it's a really extraordinary example of what the wrongfully incarcerated can sort of initiate on their own from behind bars.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've talked a lot on Prison Radio Show before many different contexts about solitary confinement, and which, just going back to something you mentioned earlier, so Albert has spent more time in solitary confinement than any other prisoner in the U.S. So could you maybe talk a bit about the role of solitary confinement in prison-led organizing, and especially in terms of the Angola 3?
Yeah, so, I mean, like I mentioned, obviously it puts them in a disadvantage. I mean, in terms of the role in prison-led organizing, I mean, that we do believe that they were targeted for their activism as organizers before they were put in solitary, and they were put in solitary as a way to silence them. At the time that they were put in solitary, it was not sort of the trend that it is now nationally and internationally, but especially nationally in the U.S., both at the state level and the federal level. In the last couple decades, solitary has become the new normal in a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of prisoners are put in solitary, not just for their own protection, but under the guise of just keeping them more manageable for whatever reason that may be, and without regard for not just the humanity or the human rights concerns of someone who's in solitary. Certainly internationally, any stint more than a few days in solitary is considered torture. But in the U.S., although Herman, Albert, and Robert are at the leading edge of it, there are now hundreds, maybe thousands of prisoners who have been in solitary, for several decades. Robert, as you guys know, he's been on the program a few times, was released after 29 years in solitary. Herman spent, almost 42 until he passed away. And Albert is now, was put in solitary, you know, 43 years in April, I guess it'll be 43, when he was, originally put into holding under pending investigation of this murder and then eventually convicted of this murder. So organizing from a solitary cell is more challenging than normal prison organizing, but he has had access to the outside world in terms of being able to write letters, and throughout time he's gotten some access to books and occasionally newspapers, and it really is an extraordinary thing that they have had the wherewithal and the personal strength to focus on this. And I think all three of them would say that part of the reason why they've managed not to go completely insane in solitary is because they've been able to focus on their organizing. So I think not only has it helped their own situation, but it in terms of, them possibly being freed and changing the situation for other inmates who are suffering in long-term solitary cells around the world, but also in terms of their own mental health, in terms of surviving this really just unimaginably horrific circumstance.
Mm-hmm. So I think you sort of mentioned this or maybe alluded to it earlier, but Albert's 68th birthday is coming up on Thursday, February 19th, so a week from today. Can you let our listeners know where they could send him a letter or a birthday card?
Yeah, I would love that, especially now because, like I said, this new news about the re-indictment came only an hour ago or so. And although Albert is very prepared for what we consider to be the last leg of his fight for freedom, he knows it might take months or years still, although he has had a state of despair. It's a very difficult time for him. I mean, I think he realizes that this is his last legal challenge. He has exhausted all of his legal options. And although it's coming out on his side, if for some reason he doesn't prevail, he will spend his life in prison, at least, hopefully not in solitary. We can continue to fight for that. But the stakes have never been higher for him. And I think everyone has experienced this, anytime you almost have something you really want, it gets much harder to sort of continue to wait. So I'm quite sure that although he's excited, he's very anxious about what might happen in the next couple months. And so although you might think he wouldn't need support, I honestly, as a close person now of his, I've been working on a case for almost a decade, I think he would love letters of support from anyone who's listening to this who has a moment. He will be 68 on the 19th, and you can send them, the simplest way would be to go to angola3.org, so that's www.angola3.org, and click on the Contact Us page. It's on the main menu, and it'll give you his mailing address in prison, and he may be transferred soon now that they've reindicted him to a state facility, but his mail would follow him. And, I think that the more that we can let him know that, that we know what he's doing, we are with him sort of to the end of this fight, and that that we believe in our hearts that he will prevail and justice will prevail, even if you don't believe that, just giving him any sort of statement of support would be really helpful right now.
Thank you so much. That's all for my questions. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, that's it. Except that the next couple weeks and months could be pretty busy. They have just recently set a tentative trial date for the civil case. It's in November of this year. That may be postponed slightly, but we probably won't go a few months beyond that. So within the next year or so, hopefully I'll talk to you again about that, because that is the case that would set a precedent for other inmates in this circumstance. So that is, Herman's legacy now that he's passed away, and certainly Robert and Albert's living legacy. They have always expressed that they want to secure their own freedom, but above all, they want to make sure that no one in any country, but especially in America, ever has to sort of endure what they have managed to survive. So the sooner we can put reasonable limits on solitary and ban the use of long-term solitary as they've experienced, the better. And that's what that case will do. So in addition to letting you know, hopefully when Albert gets out, we will also be keeping you all updated as to how their legal legacy is laid down. And hopefully, you know, 5 years from now, be talking about scores of others who are able to use that precedent to challenge their own wrongful long-term solitary confinement.
Absolutely. And yeah, we'll definitely be keeping in touch and trying to broadcast updates as they happen. Thanks so much for coming on Prison Radio Show again, Tori.
Yes, thank you too. Have a good day.
Okay, bye.
We're listening to Anasazi with Hex the System from their album Nasty Witch Rock. Next up is Shadow House with We Don't Belong. To the east, sky blood. To the west, missiles feed us to shallow graves. Tired of being the new order slaves. I'd rather live in a cave.
Stop!
This is Poison by the Wales-based band Artifact off their new demo. Coming up is Flowers and Fire with their track Fire from their February 24th, 2015 demo release.
Oh,
This is GLOSS, or Girls Living Outside of Society's S Word, with Lined Lips and Spiked Bats from their demo. Next is Seek Truth from Fact by Spite House. Lastly, we're hearing Male Patterns from their Thinking Too Much EP with the track Everyone's a Punk. Everyone's a punk. Everyone's a punk. Bitches, 100 bucks, down street, back to fuck. Everyone's a punk. Everyone's a punk. So much bullshit. I'm sick. Everyone's a punk. Everyone's a punk. You got the cash for this new trend. Fighting the pockets, we'll just pretend. We'll just pretend everyone's a punk. Drive back. Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And you can contact us with questions or comments or what have you at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.